you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com, to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
All right, it's Japan Week on Talk is Jericho. First up, former Megadeth guitar player Marty Friedman was in one of the biggest bands on the planet, and he left it all behind to move to Japan. He moved there 10 years ago because he loves the country, the music scene, the food, the language, the people. He hates driving there. You'll hear why coming up. We'll also get into his time with Megadeth, why he really left Megadeth. We'll talk about working with Dave Mustaine. We'll talk about learning the Japanese language. We'll talk about a total culture shock of leaving your entire country behind to move to a foreign place that's so different from the United States. Plus, we'll talk about his new album, Inferno, which he says is the heaviest thing he's ever recorded and released, and he's about to come back to the U.S. to tour the States for the first time in 10 years. Kambawa morishiichi des. Marty Friedman is here.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho, the pot of thunder and rock and roll. And today's episode is being supported by Burger King. Right now at Burger King, get the new extra long jalapeno cheeseburger. Feel the flame, feel the fire, feel the heat with two all-beef patties stacked with spicy jalapeno peppers. They're now part of the $2 for $5 deal. That's right, two sandwiches for $5. Only at Burger King. Limited time only. Restrictions apply. All right, I want you to try those out. Go get a couple extra long jalapeno cheeseburgers. Sit down and listen to former Megadeth guitar player Marty Friedman, who is now living in Japan. He left the United States behind because he loved the culture. He loved the vibe. He loved the people in Japan, and boy, what a culture shock it is. I talked to him live from a Tokyo hotel room. This is Japan Week, baby. Onegaishimasu. All right, I hope you enjoy the show. Watashi wa Chris Jericho. I used to know how to speak a little bit of Japanese, but Japanese is very hard to learn how to speak, as you'll find out. I'm sure I mentioned it in the Marty interview. Every place that you go has a different dialect. So if you learn Tokyo Japanese, it's different from learning Osaka Japanese or Sapporo Japanese. But I've been to Japan over 60 times, and I love going there. It is such a cool place. I pretty much grew up there. I've always had such a real affinity and a real closeness for Japan because of that. And every time I go back there, it is a little bit like a homecoming. So when I went to Japan just a few months ago for the WWE to work Finn Balor and Adrian Neville, I wanted to track down who I knew in Japan. And on Friday, we have New Japan bookers Jado and Gato, a.k.a. my old tag team partners from when I worked for WAR, Mr. Tenryu, in the early 90s, 94, 95. Also, I met them in Mexico in 93. Great stories from Jado and Gato. I've never met Marty Friedman before. It's always funny when you meet someone for the first time in your hotel room. But obviously, if you're a metal fan, you know Marty Friedman. He played with Megadeth for 10 years in their glory years. The Rust in Peace era, the Countdown to Extinction, Symphony to Destruction, the Trust era, all of Dave's greatest records in the 2000s, basically his greatest records possibly ever, were with Marty Friedman on guitar. Great, great stories, great guitar player, and the fact that he moved. You know, he's out of the States and now lives in Japan, like I said, because he loves the culture there, he loves the people, and we're going to discuss all that. You want to know what Japan is like? You want to know what it's like living in that country? We're going to talk all about it coming up. That's been a busy weekend. Three nights, WWE sold out at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York. I think that could be the first time ever that an entertainment company has done that. Maybe the circus. Maybe, you know, U2 level bands or something like that. But you're talking about a sports team or sports company or whatever it is that WWE is, entertainment company, I'd have to say that's probably right up there for an unbelievable, just an unbelievable accomplishment to be able to sell out three nights at the Barclays Center. Of course, with the NXT TakeOver, which got a huge reaction, SummerSlam, which got a huge reaction, some of it not great, and then Raw last night, which also got a huge reaction as well. I didn't get to see all three shows. I saw the NXT TakeOver, which I really enjoyed, and I saw parts of SummerSlam and parts of Raw, because I was working this weekend too. I flew out to New York City on Sunday, so I missed SummerSlam because I was on a plane, and then I did a press day for the finale of Tough Enough, which by the time you hear this has already happened. And then I flew back Monday night. So that's where I was, and that's why I wasn't at the Barclays Center. And if I'm not wrestling, I'm not there. If I'm not working, I stay out of the way. I don't like being one of those guys that hangs out backstage. Probably never will be. Just not my thing. If I'm going to be doing something on the show, I will be there or be square. But if not, I stay the hell away. Got a couple thoughts about everything. Number one, the SummerSlam finish, which I know is very controversial, where Brock Lesnar and Undertaker were locked in a submission. Brock had Undertaker in a submission, and then Undertaker tapped out. The ref didn't see it. The timekeeper did. Rang the bell. There was confusion. Undertaker then kicked Brock in the balls and put him in his submission, the Hell's Gate, and Brock passed out. So here's the thing, all right? People that are complaining about this finish and don't like it, you're not seeing the full story. It's like, I probably am assuming, and I don't have any inside information in this, that Brock and Undertaker are going on to WrestleMania, and that would be the rubber match at WrestleMania 32. And if that's the case, then this is just part of the story, and it might not be something that you like, but you have to wait until the thing goes its full distance. So right now, if you don't like that finish, you could be just reading the first 10 chapters of the book, and there's another 10 chapters to come. There was a movie that I went and saw called The Empire Strikes Back. Everybody knows it. When that came out, I hated the finish of that movie. I walked out of that theater crying. I was 10 years old. It's a terrible ending for the good guys. Han Solo encased in carbonite, possibly dead. We don't know. Luke Skywalker's hand chopped off. The Rebel Alliance in complete disarray. Darth Vader looming over everything, laughing like a giant bloated spider. Not a good way to end a movie. But guess what? It wasn't the end of the story. It was just the end of that chapter of the movie. So there you have it. Then Return of the Jedi happens, and everything gets resolved. Everybody lives happily ever after. But if you only watch the first two Star Wars movies, you'd never know that. You need to watch all three to figure out what's going on. If you watch Pulp Fiction and stop after an hour, you're going to go, what the hell is going on in this movie? You need to watch the whole thing to see the whole plot line of the story, the whole element of the story, the whole story arc. The ups and downs. That's the way it works. That's what we do in the WWE. And sometimes you have to, you know, live with the fact that the finish might not go where you want it to go. It was a controversial ending. Everybody's talking about it. Maybe the execution of it wasn't great, which surprises me a little bit. I think there's some weird camera angles on it. But overall, it's a good finish if you're trying to figure out a way for this story to continue. I actually really like it. I also really like the heelish elements of what The Undertaker is doing now. I bet you a lot of people are like, Undertaker could never turn heel. He's an icon. He's a legend. The best can always turn heel. The best can always manipulate your emotions. And that's what Undertaker was doing. And I really enjoy that element of it. I love the fact that he came back and he's able to control the fans that way and get some boos, which is, you know, you would think it's pretty much impossible. So I love the match. I think it's the match they probably were hoping to have at WrestleMania last year, 2 years ago, whenever it was. And I love the finish. Even though it's not the most satisfying finish, it's a great way to keep the door open to continue this. The match must continue. And I love that element of it. So kudos to that match. I actually love the finish of it and give it a thumbs up. I want to talk about two more things. The other thing, the Sting reveal, I thought was great. It reminded me of an old school, you know, early 90s, late 80s, something you'd see on Saturday Night's Main Event. And you don't get logical on me, guys. Pro wrestling's not logical, you know. Oh, well then, so Sting, you mean to tell me he got in there, removed the statue, took it somewhere we don't know, stood under the curtain, nobody noticed he was under there. Just shut up and enjoy the show, please. It was a great reveal when that curtain came up and it was Sting and everyone's reaction, the crowd's reaction. I love it. I love stuff like that. And I think it's a great way to use Sting. Sting versus Rollins at the next pay-per-view is amazing. I think that's a great idea. it gives me some fire. I enjoy the thought of it. I also enjoy the fact the Dudleys are back. I think the Dudleys are a great team together. And we'll bring a little bit of that 90s attitude era work style to the ring, which is good. You need guys with more experience because everybody's at the same level now and everyone's working great, but it's good to have guys with some experience in there to think of things in a different way, like Bubba and D-Von will. So thumbs up to that. I thought it was a great Raw for surprises, for all that sort of stuff. I think the biggest problem on the WWE right now is the tale of two cities for the Divas Revolution. All right. Best match on TakeOver, or one of the best matches, top two, was Sasha Banks, Sasha. You can hear her on Talk is Jericho a few weeks ago, versus Bayley. They tore the house down. It was amazing. And then two nights later, one of the worst segments on Raw was the Divas on Miz TV and then the match. And here's the difference. Bayley and Sasha have a distinct character, have a distinct storyline, and had a singles match, a singles feud, a legit war for this title. Okay? We know who they are. We know what's at stake. We know what they're doing. Then they come to Raw, and there's nine girls on the show. You can't push nine people at once. You can't. They introduced too many people in too short a time frame and put them all together and mixed them all together. So now it's just one big wash. And I think also when you had those four horsemen, whatever you want to call it, in NXT of Sasha, Bayley, Becky, and Charlotte, those four worked together. It's like Jericho, Guerrero, Malenko, and Benoit back in the 90s. You can't put us with other guys that aren't of that level and expect the same type of matches. And those girls in the WWE are working hard, the Bellas and Alicia Fox and Paige. But those four from NXT, they just know each other better. They're cut from a different cloth. They work together better, so they're going to be having better matches. So just because you bring a bunch of girls in and give them time, it doesn't really matter because you're not giving them time to do anything. Giving them time to do six-person matches or nine-person matches. Another thing is, we don't know any of those girls. We don't know any of their personalities. I mean, they tried a little bit on Miz TV, but you know, it's just not that. That's, I just think the fact is there's just too many people being introduced. And that includes all nine of them, because even though we know the Bellas and Fox and Tamina and Naomi and everybody else, we're introducing three new teams: Team PCB, Team BAD, Team Bella. We've got three new squads with three girls in each. That's three times, you know, nine. It's like 27 new squads or something, whatever it is. There's a lot of new characters to digest, and it's hard to do that in such a quick period of time. So there's going to be some growing pains. I have no doubt that those girls can tear the house down, but we need to know their characters a bit more, and we need to focus on just individuals for once and not try and push all nine of them at once because it's too much. It's like Pat Patterson used to say, you need a jigsaw puzzle. You need to have one piece lead to another, not a three rings circus. And he's right. Three ring circus, you're looking at everything at once. You can't pay attention to everything. It's kind of what's going on with the Diva Revolution. So I think all the Divas are talented. I think the four from NXT, even though Bayley's not here yet, are off the charts talented. But I think it's not working right now in the WWE because it's too much at once. And once they kind of split it up a bit and slow down on who they're trying to push and choose specific names rather than all nine, I think it's going to work a whole hell of a lot better. That's just my opinion. Not saying I'm the expert of anything. It's just what I think. But good 3 days for the WWE and a good week here. It's been a good week for the WWE, and it's going to be a good week here on Japan Week, starting with former Megadeth guitar player Marty Friedman live in Tokyo.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Right back in the Tokyo hotel room with Marty Friedman.
What's happening?
Guitar player extraordinaire.
Thank you very much.
And the funniest... Thank you very much. Thank you. The funniest thing is that... and I don't even know if you remember this, But 10 years ago, my band Fozzy, we did a record called All That Remains, and you played a solo on one of our tracks. And we've never actually met face to face. And I'm not sure exactly how that happened. Was it through the producer? Was it through Rick Beato?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And if I remember, I haven't heard from Rick since then, but I remember he was just the most excellent guitar player.
Yeah.
Yes. And I learned so much from that guy.
Really?
And he said, dude, you want to play on this thing? And I'm like, sure. You're like, anything he'd ask me to do, I would have done
it. Do it, yeah.
And I heard it. The song was jamming.
Yeah, it was a really fast kind of thrashy, heavy song.
It's a real metal song.
Yeah.
And that's all I remember of it. But I just remember that it was because Rick asked me to do it. And he's an amazing guitar player.
Yeah, he was producing the record that was in Atlanta.
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, I can get Marty Friedman on this. I'm like, yeah, whatever. Sure, you can. He's like, no, I can. And then here we go, you know, 2 weeks later, yeah, Marty sent in his solo. It's like, what?
Yeah.
That's great. You know, so it's always
now
cool.
We finally meet
face to face.
Yeah.
All the way over, you know, other side of the world here in Tokyo, Japan,
yes.
Which is where you live.
True.
And you have for many, many, many years.
Yes, for 10 years.
For 10 years.
Yeah.
So I remember I've been in Japan. I've been coming here since 91.
Oh.
So it's been maybe 45 times for me.
Wow.
And I learned how to read katakana by reading Burn Magazine.
Awesome.
Which is the metal magazine that you actually wrote a column for.
Yes.
In Japanese.
In Japanese, yes.
How did you end up becoming so involved in Japan and end up moving here?
Well, I started off in a very similar way. The katakana is like, as you know, it's like the words that are not Japanese.
Right.
So if you see a picture, Chris Jericho, there's your picture, and your name's written in katakana, it's like decoding something. It's like, Kurisu Jericho.
That's right.
That must be ku. That must be di. So like, that's how you start. And then I started to really get crazy and really wanted to learn everything, all the kanji and all of the Japanese writing and reading and the language. Little by little, I came many times like you did on tour and doing stuff. I started doing interviews in Japanese and started doing everything pressure point. You know, you got to put yourself in there, you know.
Yeah, right.
So like you do a live radio interview in Japanese, you got to be on it, you know. So I just forced myself to learn that way. And then the next thing you know, after several years of doing that, it just became really natural.
Because it's hard trying to learn how to speak Japanese.
Sure.
Because, you know, you go to Mexico, Spanish is very locked in. But Japanese is different dialect in different parts of the country,
sure,
right?
Sure.
So
sure.
Northern Japanese could be slightly different from Southern. Yeah. And when you're on tour, I would like, you know, I listen to like the whatever it was, Rosetta Stones or something, and try and get all excited and then try and say a few sentences and then no one would know what the hell I was talking about. And then it would just kill your confidence, you know?
I think a lot of it is really image. Image can shut someone's listening abilities off.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'll be rattling off something in perfect Japanese, and it may be like with older people, they'll just look at someone like me or someone like you, the image is just so overwhelming that you could be, you know, saying a dissertation in complete perfect Japanese, and they were just like, oh, no, I don't.
So they can't believe you actually know that
word. They can't believe you know it. So like that takes a little while with some older people are like that. But pronunciation is really kind of a tricky thing, and once you kind of get to understand what they understand and what they don't understand, then you sort of get it.
You're right too, because it's like even when you were talking about Chris and the name Chris in katakana, it's like you said, it's almost written like our alphabet. Like it's like the k sound is almost like a backwards block C.
Right.
So, and that, you know, if you're going into hiragana or kanji, those are the characters that are very involved and looks like gibberish to us.
Right.
But when you can read that katakana, like you said, like kuriso, if you can kuriso. Say kuriso, you know, then if you pronounce that, you're not just saying, hey, Chris, kuriso. Then it's like, they can kind of relate to that a little bit better, you know?
Yes.
That's how you figure it out. Because we would go to like truck stops or something like that. And you know, in the truck stops here, they have all the food. It's kind of like plastic versions of it.
Right.
And you'd point to the hotcakes, if you want like pancakes. Hotcakes. And they'd stay like, what? Hotcakes. What? Hey, translator, hotcakes. Hotakeke.
Sometimes you just say the word with the Japanese accent and it works.
That's right,
Not hotcakes, hotakeke. You
know, okay.
That one. Yeah.
Meanwhile, if someone came up to you or I and we're working at a restaurant, they said they want hotakeke, you'd be like, okay, this guy wants hotcakes. But here it's like, no, understand.
Once you figure that out, then you can kind of get away with stuff.
Right.
You know, like in Spanish, you know, people put an O at the end of it.
Yeah.
Gasolino or something like that. It's kind of like that.
Yeah. How was it for you to make the transition to move over here to Japan full time?
It was, I was very lucky because the reason I came to be here is because I wanted to be in domestic Japanese music. I've been in international music for my whole career.
Yeah, you've been playing in Megadeth for years.
One of the biggest
metal bands. You're one of the most gifted rock and roll guitar players. Everyone knows Marty Friedman.
Oh, thank you very much. I love that. But like, I started to listen to Japanese domestic music a lot, like all the time. And I just like, you know, I want to be in this music scene. And it was just like, that was the real reason that I came here. Mm. So could have been a culture shock, but like I was just too driven to do what I wanted to do. I wanted to play the music here, the music of this country. And the, I don't know how familiar you are with Japanese music. I mean, it goes everything from Visual K to J-pop to really ultra, ultra heavy music.
Yeah, fairly familiar. Like, not all the bands, but I know, like, you know, X-Japan. And
I know you're a metalhead, so I should turn you on to some things, write down some stuff for you before I go. Because they got some stuff that's so extreme metal that, you know, you'd probably go, wow.
But only popular within Japan.
Only known within Japan.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So there's a lot of different bands and styles here just in this small country.
Right. And that's what blew my mind. And I wanted to be in that scene. It was just like really stimulating, you know? So that's what I got. That's the reason I came here. And I really didn't get like culture shocked as bad as you might think. I got lucky right away. I joined the band of one of my favorite singers, like within 3 months.
Who is that?
Icon Anase.
Okay.
She's kind of a household name. Pop, rock, some of it gets towards metal, some of it gets towards ballads. It goes the whole thing. Actually doing a show with her on the 7th of this month.
Okay.
But I've done stuff with every single Japanese artist that I really, really wanted to work with, and I've really been very lucky to kind of assimilate here while keeping my international solo projects going and stuff like that. But the reason I came here was mainly because I wanted to be part of the domestic music scene.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me too, because, you know, you have such a name value, and I've done this too. You want to reinvent yourself. Yeah. You have such a name value as Marty Friedman of Megadeth. When you came to Japan and you want to play for what was the artist's name again?
Icon Anase.
Did you just call them, or did you kind of put out a, like, Marty's in town?
No, I didn't do anything. And the thing is, when in Japan, Japanese music scene, it's international and domestic, and they do not cross. So even though I was a well-known guitarist, you know, having toured with Megadeth and my previous band, Cacophony, touring Japan a lot, it was all international. So I had no connections in the world of domestic music. Didn't know anybody. Mm-hmm. So it's like I was this new guy. This new foreign guy is all I was, starting from zero.
So you started from scratch.
So literally from scratch.
So did you have to audition for her?
Well, I actually had a mutual friend who introduced us, and we had dinner together. We got along so great. Next day, I got a call from her manager, want to join the band. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, shit, yeah, man, I want to do that. And the funny thing was, all of her fans are domestic music fans. So they don't know Megadeth. They don't know any kind of foreign things. They might not even know U2 or Metallica.
Okay.
Domestic fans really mainly listen to domestic music, and international mainly listen to international. Mm-hmm. So here I was playing. Nobody knows who I am. I'm like jamming my ass off, and it's like, man, who's this long-haired American dude, you know? Never heard of him. I guess he's all right, you know?
Right.
So I had to start off like making one fan at a time and one thing at a time, and next thing you know, I'm really assimilated into that.
So is this kind of like like, for example, Rihanna right now has, like, Nuno Bettencourt playing with her. Is this kind of the same thing where, like, you're just ripping up the solo when it's necessary, but other than that, you're just playing the tunes and kind of just adding the musicianship?
It's kind of similar as, like, she's the main person like Rihanna, but Aikawa Nanase's music is much more guitar-oriented music. So it really needs a big guitar presence. And the reason that she heard one of my solo records and says, this is the guy. And I just happened to be a fan of hers for many years, so it worked out. But similar to Rihanna in that sense that there's like a guitarist there, but like more the music is definitely guitar-based, whereas Rihanna's more of an R&B.
So do you tour a lot with her or with all the different acts?
Actually, in Japan, it's a small country, so like whoever goes on tour, they don't go on tour for very long.
So maybe 10 shows you can play or
a lot.
Maybe.
You know, the longest tour I've ever done was with Aikawa Nanase. It was 25 shows in Japan, and that's a lot.
And you're playing every little
possible
farm town,
place,
yeah,
yes. So, but I basically do one thing with her a year, maybe, if that, okay. or every other year. You know, I'm usually much busier with other things, but we've had such a great rapport that she calls me when she has a big show, and I'll do that.
Okay. Yeah. So is there other bands that you work with as well?
Plenty of other bands, other projects. I do a lot of producing. I do a lot of recording. I do my own stuff is the main thing I'm doing right now. So I've touring the world with Inferno, already toured Japan. I'm playing at Summer Sonic, the big festival
right
here.
Right here, yeah.
And I did Loud Park last year, and I toured Europe twice. But I've never toured America with my solo as Marty Friedman, ever. I did a short run of California, but I'm not counting that.
Yeah, let's see. This is a real one.
This is the real one.
Because I looked at the dates, and it's a pretty extensive tour.
Yeah, for me, in coming to America for that long, never done it before. And I'm so stoked about it.
How often do you go back to the States?
I go like maybe once a year for, you know, promotional type of things or shoot a video or whatever. And
but you're pretty much Japanese.
I'm in Japan, man. live here, man.
That must be exciting for you just to go back to the States in general to go tour around and see everything again.
Well, you know, the main thing is I miss my family and I miss my friends of being America. But in Japan, I mean, I just love everything else. I mean, you know, from being here 40 times.
Yeah.
It's a cool place.
It's great.
It's a really cool place. So I really love it. I love America too, but like my life is here. But I'm just really interested in, like, there's a lot of people in America. I'm sure they've forgotten who the hell I am.
Yeah.
And there's some people.
He's still alive.
Or yeah. There's some people who supported me. It's like, the guy's probably never going to come back and play for us. Or that bastard, he's like, he's never coming back.
Right.
I've always wanted to come back. It's my homeland. I love it. My life is here in Japan, but like it doesn't mean I don't love America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important to me to go and just blow minds on this tour. You know, I never left for good. You know, I just wanted to, do my thing in Japan. But being in America is very important for me.
Do you have a band that you're putting together for the tour?
Yeah, I have a solo band. We've toured everywhere else but America. And a couple Japanese members, American members, and I've done it with European members. I've toured with all kinds of different people who are my support band. Band is going to blow your mind. It's going to blow your mind.
And it's all instrumental?
All instrumental. There might be a vocal song or two in there. There's a lot of surprises.
But that's what you do.
Yeah.
That's what you've done with all your solo records, even with Cacophony.
Right.
Did Cacophony have a singer?
We had vocals, but we were mostly instrumental.
Yeah,
we had a lot of instrumental
guitar
songs.
Wizardry.
Guitar
right?
craziness, yeah.
Yeah. Is there some great guitar players over in Japan that people might not know? Is there like some musicians here, or is it more just the groups, like the J-pop groups and these different artists, the singers?
I find myself not really gravitating to guitarists. Because there's so many great guitarists everywhere. And I'm kind of more impressed with an artist, a musician, or like a band or artist, the Japanese. The first one I would say, I mean, if you're a metal fan, you really must know about Maximum the Hormone, if you haven't heard of them.
Maximum the Hormone.
Maximum the Hormone.
Classic Japanese English,
yeah,
right? It doesn't quite make sense.
It doesn't make sense. You will dig it. It's
really?
The most adrenalized, pumped, steroided out, full-on... I don't know if that's a bad word in your world
but
like for me, I mean, it's just, I feel like I'm on steroids when I listen to their music.
Wow, that pumped up,
right? It's very pumped. It's very high energy, ultra deep metal with kind of a punk. It's very cool. I'll write it down for you
so you
can check it out later.
Because there's always been bands, like when I first came here, like I said, in 91, X-Japan.
Right.
And I know, they just played The Garden.
Yeah, X-Japan
is crazy.
They are the godfathers of... electronic, heavy...
symphonic, heavy metal, piano-based...
And visual. Visual game
visual
music.
Shock.
Visual Shock.
That's
they were like one
gimmick,
of the first
yeah.
bands to like do something really visual. You know, up until then, it was kind of like, you know, kind of... not dumbed down. What's the word I'm looking for? I'm thinking in Japanese.
Isn't that weird, right?
Kind of drab and kind of dry, you know, kind of like... organic, you know, but X-Japan is like full-on visual violence kind of thing.
It was like psychedelic violence, crime of visual shock.
There you go. Yeah,
it said that on the logo. I remember.
It's amazing that you remember that.
I remember walking into a store and I was just looking for something metal, and because I didn't know if I'd ever be back to Japan, I didn't know.
Right.
And I just saw that poster, and it was very, very strange and cool. And right off the bat, I actually used one of their songs as my ring song.
Really? Which song?
Silent Jealousy.
Oh my god.
Yeah. So. Because before that, when you were talking old school metal guys, you know, you think Japanese metal, it's loudness.
Right.
right. you know, loudness. And when I came over, I thought like loudness must be like soup, and they're like, they're popular at points, but it's not like they're massively huge.
Well, it's a, here's the thing about loudness. Loudness was what did something that a lot of bands want to do, and they broke into the American market to some extent.
Right.
And I think loudness as a representative of Japan is almost like, it's not Japanese sounding music. It's not, to me, it sounds very influenced by American metal.
Absolutely.
Godfathers. So right. what's happening, I would even consider them international music, not mm-hmm. domestic Japanese mm-hmm. music. When you hear something like X Japan, or more currently Maximum the Hormone, or say Gazette or Sid or Mary or Mook or bands like this, you'll hear very, very Japanese influence and very deep, heavy, heavy music.
Okay. So. Yeah, because there is a certain Japanese style. Like when you mentioned, you know, X Japan, for example. Right. I'm not going to say there's a little bit, like we talk about little orchestration. Now there's a little anime. There's a little bit right. of strangeness. Because right. Japanese, Japan as a country, I say this with the ultimate respect because I love Japan. It's a little bit of a strange country. This is a country where you can go on the subway and people are reading giant comics of like huge penises attacking girls.
Right? Yeah, it's very normal.
Yeah, very normal stuff very here. Normal. The businessmen are just reading it. Here's a giant
I forgot
cock.
That's strange.
Yeah, you don't even know anymore, right?
Yeah, I don't even notice that.
But Kiss just had a huge hit here with Momo Clover, right?
Yeah.
And that had a little bit of a J-pop vibe to it, but that was smart for them to do that. Because it was huge, right?
Fantastic. I think it's great. I did a great thing with Momo Clover. Mm-hmm. I did one of their singles.
Okay.
And it was a big news, actually, because I was like the first like guest to like come and play guitar all over all their music,
right.
which was not very guitar-based at all. It's kind of electronic, dancey, kind of idolish music. And here I am just ripping this guitar all over it. So it's like, oh my God, it's a shock. You know. So it was kind of a big thing. And then they started having lots of guests, and it led to them doing something with Kiss.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's... They are a huge, huge thing right now in Japan.
And they're five
girls.
Girls, they're kind of like schoolgirls, even though they're older, but they kind of have that gimmick, and it's like kind of like, for lack of a better term, like a Spice Girls thing. They're all singing and dancing together.
Right.
But it's massive, right?
It's massive. It's really massive, and I think Kiss saw just how massive it was. And I think it took a lot of balls for Kiss to do it, because Kiss's fans are totally different than Momo Clover's fans. Kiss's fans are more like they're older. Mm-hmm. They're like, they like their traditional sound. What do they care about these five idol girls? And why are my favorite Kiss guys playing with these idol girls? It took balls to do it, I think. And you know, Kiss has always been a band that does what they want to do. And I applaud them for
it. Smart move, because they played a Tokyo Dome show. You know, not as a result of it, but it definitely didn't hurt that they had Momo Clover.
It certainly didn't
song.
Hurt. And, it, you know, it's tough, you know, because you could piss off both fans.
Yeah, just polarize everybody.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com, to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
So, Marty, we're talking about the Tokyo Dome. Have you played in the Tokyo Dome before?
Yeah, many times.
Really?
Actually, Tokyo Dome, I wanted to remember to say this. The last time I played in the Tokyo Dome was last year, New Year's Day, I think it was New Year's Day, with Hiroshi Tanahashi. Now, you must know who he is.
I just remember this, too. He's from New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Yes.
He's a big star in the biggest wrestling company here in Japan.
Yes. So I don't know the condition, the things, be the relationship between where you're, what you do and what he does.
It's the same. It's the Japanese version of WWE. Like, I worked for New Japan many times over my 45 tours, because we used to come here and wrestle for Japanese companies. We'd be the gaijin. There'd be, you know, five or six gaijin with the whole crew.
Right.
So New Japan is the biggest company here in Japan that does a Tokyo Dome show every year.
Now, when I saw at that show, I was like, I don't really know much about wrestling. Mm-hmm. I mean, back in the Megadeth days, I did stuff with Goldberg, and
Crush
we did some fun stuff, and you know, with the girls, and I don't really know much more than that. Other than everybody I've met in the world of that has been really, really super cool, and not as nearly as scary as you would think. So when Hiroshi Tanahashi asked me to do this thing at the Tokyo,
so he asked you,
he asked me,
wow.
And what he asked me to do was, he does this thing where he plays air guitar.
Like as his ring entrance?
One of his things that he does.
Yeah.
So what he wanted to do was have me come out and play real guitar with him as he goes into the ring. So we're going through the entire Tokyo Dome together. It's just massive.
Right.
It's massive. And I'm jamming this song on guitar for real. And he's standing next to me. I look like about one inch yeah. tall. But we're going through the whole Tokyo Dome and the people are just going completely apeshit.
Right.
And I'm like, this is so much bigger than rock. And I'm like jamming with him. And then he does his thing. And then he did his, I guess it, what's Shiai in English? You call it a fight or you
his
call
fight,
it
his
you
match. Call it a,
his match, yeah. match, right. This thing required so much energy
mm-hmm.
and it was so long and so completely on. Like,
yes.
I was just like completely blown away. And then after, before and after we did our jam thing together, I was just blown away by this, what I saw and the amount of energy and power.
And just being that close up to it as well.
That close up to yeah. it and seeing a real person do it. When you see it on TV, there's all the different angles yeah. and stuff. I'm still like, wow, this dude is doing something. It's not human.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely a very, there's a lot of relations between rock and roll and wrestling.
For example,
they're both very much, when you're performing in front of a live audience, it's very much dictated by the energy from the crowd. It's a very symbiotic relationship. If you have a great crowd, mm. it's going to make for a great show. And even mm. if you don't play every note perfectly, if the mm. crowd's going nuts, mm. that's all that matters. Mm. Or if you do the perfect match and every move fits in and everything works out and the crowd's sitting on their hands and nobody cares, it sucks. So it's very hard-hitting, aggressive form of entertainment. You want the people to be involved. Mm. You want them to sing along or chant along or react. Mm. So I think it's probably the same if you were a stand-up comedian or, you know, where you have that energy that you feed off of. Mm. You know what I'm saying? Mm. So there is those similarities there.
Mm. You know? And I probably can't imagine anything that would require more training, preparation.
Well, you know what, though, dude? It's once again, once you train, you know, when you learn how to play guitar, you learn how to wrestle, and then you just go start doing it, right? Mm. At this point for us, you're training, maybe doing some weights or push-ups or whatever, but when we get to the arena, it's like jamming with another guitar player.
Really?
It's like, okay, well, let's start with this chord, and we'll finish with this, and in the middle, let's just trade off. Let's see what we feel. Wow. So there's a lot of improv element to it as well.
That's interesting. Because what I saw, the first thing that I thought was like, say you watch like baseball or football, these guys constantly are taking breaks.
Mm-hmm.
You get on base and you wait or whatever.
Right.
But what I saw, it was constantly go, 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 on the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess in some ways is like music, but
sure
that level of intensity from the note one to the end, that was what really blew my mind.
Yeah, because like, you're on the whole time.
Yeah,
I think it's like being the front man. If you know, like even like with Fozzy, if we do a 90-minute set, I sweat way more at a rock show than I do in wrestling.
Because really?
You're on the whole time, but you can ebb and flow the pace. Mm. You can put a guy in a hold and kind of take a breath and kind of assess what's going on. So there's secrets and magic to
I'm
both.
Sure.
You know,
both, yeah.
When you're talking about Japan, I mean, the number one thing when people first come over here is the food,
right?
I mean, I know some great places to go. I love Yakiniku and Yakitori, but was it strange for you when you first came over here with some of the different stuff that they eat?
Well, like you, I mean, I've been here so many times beforehand, so I was already, that was a big plus for me because I love the food here. So that was an easy part. And it's easy to eat healthy and delicious in Japan.
Hmm.
Back home in America, it's like, it's easy to eat delicious, but it's hard to eat healthy and delicious at the same time. I mean, there's so much more fish here, and there's just a lot less emphasis on making junk food delicious here.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about making healthy food kind of delicious. So if you eat yakiniku, it's just beef, but there's not a whole lot of junk going on.
Just slices
of
beef
and stuff. It's very simple food things here. I found it.
What do you like? What's some of your favorite foods here?
I love sushi. I love yakiniku.
Uh-huh.
All kinds of noodles. Pretty much everything. Pretty much. I really like the fact that when you don't have time, you can get something fast that's good.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like fast food.
Like fast. For example, you can get sushi that goes around in a circle.
Oh.
You sit down, you eat, you're done in 5 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. It goes in the circle. Tell us some more like interesting things that are only here. Like the one that I like is the parking garages that go in a circle.
Right.
So you park your car and it'll take you like a Ferris wheel and stop so that you don't have to worry about having whole buildings. It's just one big tower.
Right, right.
You know, is there other stuff like that that you've noticed?
There's
here?
Lots of stuff like that. I mean, when you live here, they totally don't come to mind.
Yeah.
But like the first one, I guess, is the toilets. You can't. The Japanese toilets, you know, once you go there, you can't go back.
Well, the heated seats.
There are heated seats. There's like streams that. I don't know how they find the places they need to find, but they find them.
Like bidets sort
of
thing. Yeah,
it's like a real, real modern convenience. And the bathtubs, you know, that speak to you and tell you how hot it is and how hot it needs to be. And
really?
Yeah, they adjust it to it. However, you know, it's very modern.
I've bathtubs. Never seen that.
It might even be, I'll look in this room right here. I'm sure you can adjust the things and you don't have to like feel the water to make sure it's hot or not. It gets to the exact temperature you want.
You like said it before.
You said it before and you can and time it, you know, for when you get home, the bath is ready for you and stuff like that.
That's great, man. Do you live in Tokyo?
I live in Tokyo.
Downtown?
This is right here. We're in Akasaka right now.
Yeah.
And I live in Shinjuku, which is about 20 minutes away.
So do you mostly take the train or subway?
I take taxi pretty much everywhere, and my manager drives me everywhere. And
do you have a car?
I don't drive.
What's the point? Oh, you don't even drive.
What's the point? I'd be afraid to drive on the wrong side of the road here.
It's so crazy too.
Anyway,
right?
Yeah. And my manager wouldn't trust me. Wouldn't trust me.
So we talked about how you came over to Japan after being in Megadeth for so many years. And I mean, so many great songs you guys wrote together, and it was like that was probably a 10-year period.
10 years, yeah.
That you were in, you're in that band, and that really kind of puts you on the map.
Yeah.
As this guitar player,
there's no doubt about that.
To tell us a little bit about that, about your relationship with Dave, how was it playing with him? We know the intensity of Dave and the genius and insanity of Mustaine. He's been on this show before too. Mm. Very cool guy, but also very wacky sometimes.
Sure.
To be in a band with him for 10 years, that's a long, you could be the longest guy to ever be in Megadeth besides Dave Ellison, I'd say.
Yeah, you know, I have nothing but good.
That's cool.
Good vibes. I have nothing but good memories about the band in general, about Dave in general. We were a very good combination together. I find that he always has something interesting to say. You know, if you let him talk, you know, sometimes he'll say things that might get him in trouble or the band in trouble or that other people might not like and I may not like. And I found myself not liking a lot of things that he said. But I think for a singer, it's imperative to at least be interesting. And there's one thing that you can always say about him. He's always interesting.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And, yeah. So, like, I never held that really against him. And I just think he's a unique character. And I always loved him. And I still do. And I wish him nothing but the absolute best in music or whatever he does. So,
now, the big storyline going around for a while was that there might be a reunion of you guys. I've heard that every time one of Dave's guitar player leaves, people are like, Marty Friedman will come back. Did you actually ever talk about it all this last time after Chris Broderick left? Did you guys have a conversation about it at all?
Well, I don't know. I don't really follow the news and what has been, you know, publicized.
Yeah, well, in the States, the rumor, you know, the word going around was that this is it. It's the reunion of the classic Rust in Peace lineup.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you guys even talked about that.
Yeah, well, we did talk about it. I'll keep the answer short.
Right.
We talked about it. Time just wasn't right. And I considered it because I love the guys. I love the band. Mm. And if it was something that was looked like it was going to be something worth doing, I would always consider it now and forever. And just like any band that, you know, I may talk to. I mean, I've done so many projects. And the only thing that I've really had as a criteria is that I love to do it.
Mm.
If it looks like something I love to do, I jump on it.
Mm-hmm.
I've done millions of things here in Japan, some very strange. Me and Momoiro Clover is just, it's off the hook. But I love it, so I did it. So the same exact criteria goes with anything Megadeth would ever come up to me with. I would be glad to hear anything that they would be into offering, or any band really, mm-hmm. or anything real. Because I think as an artist and as a musician, it's your obligation to at least entertain the possibilities of this collaboration or that collaboration, because that's where wonderful things are born in music.
Right.
And at least to entertain any kind of option. So I feel that same exact way about anything.
Would it be hard to go back and play just straight heavy metal? I'm sure, because you probably have so much stuff that you're doing. Or would you just take it as a 6-month thing and just bang it out?
It really depends on each situation, you know. I kind of like things that are new and fresh and exciting and to some extent experimental. Like when you see on my solo, when I do my solo tour, it's very, very much heavy metal. It's very guitar. There's no doubt about that. But I find that in the world of instrumental guitar music, it tends to be a show-off type of thing, and it tends to not have the heavy metal essence that I really want to get out of guitar. So
you still like having that heavy
metal
style?
I love heavy metal. Yeah. I mean, Inferno is my heaviest album ever. Mm-hmm. It's the heaviest album I've ever done. It's the deepest, darkest. It's the most Marty, for lack of a better word. But I love stuff that's heavy. But I also it has to be new. It has to be fresh.
Right.
So that's my main thing with heavy music. If it's traditional metal, it might be fun to put on a song at a party or something. But I don't think I could, you know, keep it too terribly traditional for too long.
Well, and that's the thing too, when you're talking about this upcoming tour, your very first U.S. solo tour, people are going to want to hear Metal Marty.
Well, yeah,
you know, that's kind of what they're going to want to have you play.
Exactly.
So, I mean, that's good that you're going to do that, because it's almost like if you come to Japan, you have one thing that you have to do. You go to America, that's what they're going to want to see.
Right. Well, I would have to be honest with myself, you know, before I even recorded Inferno, I'm like, what are the people who don't know what I'm doing in Japan? What do they really want me to play? Mm. I mean, do they want me to do this avant-garde Japanese weird thing? No, they want me to play my ass off. They want it to be super exotic and super metal and my own kind of style, but they want it to be really heavy. I had to be really honest with myself about that, give people what they want. And that was really the concept behind Inferno, and it's definitely the concept behind my American tour.
So when you tour, you're looking forward to, I mean, is it a bus, in a van, whatever it is, you know, back on the streets, back on the road, because touring is getting harder and harder nowadays just to keep it rolling.
Yeah, I mean, I love it. I've toured Europe a lot with my solo stuff, so I always love that. America is a bigger country.
Yeah.
Than France or Germany, and it's all speaking the same language.
Yeah.
And no passport stuff. And it seems like it's going to be a lot easier than a lot of the touring in the other countries in Asia and Europe. And of course, touring in Japan, I'm used to it and I love it. Mm-hmm. I do it all the time.
But like you said earlier, it's only so many cities you can do. It's
only so many cities.
Small country.
So like when I do my solo tour of Japan, I might play Tokyo, Osaka, Nagoya, and maybe a festival type of thing in Saitama, Super Arena, something like that. So it's not a lot of shows. But in America, you know, I'm in the country for an entire month playing almost every day.
Right.
So I'm kind of looking forward to that. That's what I loved about touring in Europe. And I just got back from South America where I played a bunch of shows.
So you tour quite a bit worldwide.
Yeah, I do a lot of touring. But I really love, okay, tomorrow's another show, tomorrow's another show, tomorrow's another show. You get in the groove.
Right. Oh, yeah.
The one thing I don't like about being in Japan and touring is you'll rehearse for like 10 days or something, and then you'll do one show. I hate rehearsing. Yeah. I really hate it. But playing the show, it's like when you play one show or two shows, you learn so much more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's very similar in your world.
Yeah.
You learn so much more in the actual doing of the show than you do preparing for it. So when you're on tour, it's a rapid improvement of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and also too, like, you know, it takes 3 or 4 shows to get into the groove sometimes of maybe a set list or I should try this or try that. But when you only have 1 or 2 shows, it's over before you even started, you know?
Sure.
Now, let me ask you this, you know, as a singer, especially being on tour, you know, we do 5 or 6 nights a week because it's just financially better to do that. I have a pretty strong voice, so I'm pretty cool, but I'm always a little bit worried if I get sick or if you pick up some kind of a bug, because then you're shut down.
Right.
As a guitar player, can you go, you know, 20 shows in 23 nights and not have to worry about finger problems?
As a guitar player, that's one thing that I don't have to worry about, is even if you get sick, you can still play.
Right.
Luckily, I don't get sick very much. I really worry about singers because, you know, you're done if you're sick.
Yeah.
So as a guitar player, I find it's not really any kind of problem. Sometimes when I'm recording, and I like to record at a reasonable pace, you know, maybe 8 hours in a day, but sometimes you're just rocking and you're like 18 hours in there. If I was doing that for like every day, I would probably hesitate to want to put a long bunch of shows in a row after that. But I've never really had any problems with that. No.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
When we talked about Megadeth earlier, I don't really know this story. Back in 1990, how did you get that gig playing with them? Because that was like the plum gig to get was with Megadeth.
I got it through a mutual friend and a mutual friend of Megadeth's manager at the time and myself. He said, dude, Megadeth's been auditioning like a bunch of guys. It's not working out. You want to give it a shot? And I'm like, I had a Madonna audition that same
really
audition, the same week.
Yeah. No kidding.
I was like on Friday and Megadeth was on Tuesday. And so I got Megadeth, so I didn't bother going to Madonna.
Oh, you didn't bother? What song were you supposed to audition with Madonna?
With Madonna? I don't really remember. I think they just said learn a bunch of songs, and none of the songs have any guitarists that really stand out.
Oh.
So I was just planning to go in there and, you know, fill in my, with my own thing and play along with whatever they had going. But, you know, as fate had it, luckily, you know, that would have Madonna would have been a great gig, but it would have not probably done as much for me, and it definitely wouldn't have been as much fun as Megadeth.
Wouldn't have lasted as long. What did you audition with for Megadeth?
Well, I don't know about that. You know, Madonna's got a guitar player now who's a full-on metal guy.
Is that Monty?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he's on fire. That guy's amazing. So, you know, who knows? You know, you never know what's happening until you're in the actual camp.
That's true.
You know, and I don't know him personally, you know? But I know he's been in the band for a while.
He's a good guy. Yeah, and he's one of Brian Slagle's
friends. Have you met him?
Yeah. Monty, I can't remember what his last name is, but I met him through Brian Slagle, Metal Blade. He's got his own solo.
Yeah, he's a great guitar player. So, like, you never know what's going on in
the
world.
That's true. Yeah. It's funny, too, how all the girls that we're talking about with Madonna or Rihanna or the girl here in Japan, they all want the hotshot guitar player. They like that, you know?
Yeah, it's a weird thing. I don't know what that dynamic is.
Yeah.
I don't know what that dynamic is, but it's cool.
They want the rock element, maybe.
It's a cool thing.
Yeah.
It's a cool
thing. What did you audition for Megadeth? Did you remember what song you played?
I don't remember which songs I played, but I remember that they kept changing the songs they wanted me to learn. It was bumming me out. And then I got in there and I just, I think I wound up playing the songs that they originally asked me to learn.
Uh-huh.
And maybe they're just trying to like confuse me or something.
See how you doing, kid?
Yeah.
Which was great, though, because the first song that came out was Holy Wars, and it had some real classic Marty Friedman-type bits. Like, you added a lot to that song.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I enjoyed it. When they had me play in the band, they pretty much said, do your own thing.
Mm.
You know, of course, there's a very strong Mustaine element in the rhythm guitar section of Megadeth, and they definitely wanted to preserve that. Mm-hmm. And I was cool with that. But when it came to leads and other things like that, solos and that type of stuff, it was like, do your own thing. And that was very important to me because I'm not really very good at copying others.
Right.
And I wouldn't have been as useful to the band if they would have said, well, you really should copy this guy or that guy. I wouldn't have been as good as some other guys are really good at that.
Yeah.
They're great at like emulating other guys, and that's fine, but that's not my strong point at all.
Did you write some riffs sometimes for Megadeth? Or was it basically Dave writing the riffs and presenting and you're learning the rhythms and then putting your own solos on top?
I wrote some riffs, and Dave encouraged me to write a lot of riffs. The riff section of Megadeth, that's Dave's voice right there.
That's you're right, yeah.
And I love it that way, and I think the best thing about our chemistry was the fact that when his riff is playing and then my solo's playing, you've got these two different chocolate and peanut butter kind of things going on.
Was there any riffs that he gave you or any songs where it took you a while to figure out how to play the damn thing?
Not really, but it took me a while to figure out how he played in general.
Because
at the beginning, it was quite quite a task because we were going to go right on the road after recording and do all the previous material. And the rhythm stuff had to be kind of very similar to his playing.
Right.
And, I'm not really great at emulating other people. I have a very weird and not very cool-looking style. And so, yeah, you got to play the rhythms like this. I'm like, so that was kind of difficult. That was difficult. But once I got that, then I kind of unlocked the key to the way the rhythms
once
go.
Once you figured out the style of his rhythm playing.
Yeah, it's very stylized. As my lead playing is very stylized, his rhythm playing is also very stylized. So learning that, it was kind of a pain in the ass, mm-hmm. you know? And it was worth it in the end, and I got it. I understood it. It was like, that's his band, and that's the way
right.
he wants it. In most bands, rock and metal, if there's two guitar players, they play kind of different inversions, different ways of
sure.
playing the guitar parts. You know, one guy will play it up top, one yeah. guy will play it below. And that's the way it works usually. And that usually gives you a wide sound and it's mm-hmm. cool. But actually, and I learned this from Mustaine, he said, if you both play exactly the same rhythm, it gives you this big thickness. I mean, that's why people double stuff in the studio to make it thick.
Of course, right.
But usually live, you got like in Aerosmith, you got Brad and Joe, they're doing different parts. Mm-hmm. And that's got its own cool vibe, but it's kind of loose. But when in Megadeth, I don't know what Metallica does. They probably do the same
thing.
Similar
thing, yeah.
If you both play the exact same rhythms live, it's just this massive wall of heaviness. And I'm like, okay, now I get it. It's kind of a pain in the ass. I wanted to do it the other way. I wanted to do it the easy way. But it was worth it. So,
were you a Megadeth fan beforehand?
I had heard some stuff.
Okay.
I was actually a bigger Metallica fan,
gotcha.
To be honest
yeah,
with you.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was a Megadeth fan. I just wasn't very. I didn't really know the members,
hadn't played the tunes.
And but I was a Metallica fan from the early days of the first demo.
Oh wow! Okay, from No Life to Leather.
Yes.
Are you a California guy?
I lived there for a lot, but I lived in Hawaii when that came out.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
And like I was probably one of three guys who knew who they were, and I'm like, no one's ever gonna pick up on this. It's too rad. These guys are too rad. It's never gonna get popular.
How did you find that in Hawaii?
I had a band called Hawaii, and we were actually.
You were in Hawaii?
I was in the band Hawaii. You've heard of Hawaii?
I used to hang out at the record store in Winnipeg, Canada, where I'm from, and flip through every album. Like remember there was like hundreds of metal albums.
Right.
And I remember Hawaii. There was like a
the worst album cover.
A wave on the cover or something like that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
I remember seeing, because I'm like, that's an interesting name.
Yeah.
I didn't know that you were in that.
Yeah, what it was is like really, really intense, just like balls out, way non-commercial, balls out metal,
uh-huh.
kind of influenced by new wave of British heavy metal and stuff like that.
Right.
So kind of like from the same area as Metallica, Megadeth type of thing. So my circle of underground friends had all the tapes from all the bands that were coming up, and I heard the No Life Till Leather tape.
Uh-huh.
No Life Till Leather.
Leather, yeah.
And I'm like, this is it. I mean, it's metal, but it's like sounds like punk. It's fast. The leads are cool. The rhythms are cool. The vocals are cool. I was like jogging to this. This was the one time in my life that I was like into health because it was making me run. I was loving it. So I was really into that.
And once again, Dave is on that. Obviously, that
Dave was on that.
Yeah,
so like, I'm
sure,
like,
yeah.
That was very, very cool.
Yeah. So, it's amazing too when you listen to that cassette or you listen to Kill 'Em All at the time, just how over the top, fast and thrashy and heavy it was.
Right.
And now all those songs on the radio every day, and there's 1,000 bands playing music that fast and heavy. But at the time, there was nobody.
Forget it.
Like Metallica.
Forget it.
Nobody. It's very polarized, where people are going, turn this shit off. What is this crap? Same ones that are now, you know, bouncing big beach balls during Seek and Destroy at the end of the set, right?
It's become a very good world.
Yeah, right.
If you ever thought that 20 years later, however many years later, that would be what that, was
yeah.
happening. No way, man.
Ever. You get
no
the
way.
Hot chicks bouncing the balls.
No
and it's
way.
Like, what happened?
I love it.
Who were your some of your favorite guitar players when you were growing up?
Growing up, you know, it was all about Kiss and the Ramones for
okay.
me, and Black Sabbath, Mahogany Rush, and
underrated.
Uli John Roth, and that was pretty much it.
Mm.
Once I started getting kind of past those guys, I really stopped listening to guitar altogether, and I was just on a quest to make the heaviest music of all time, and that was pretty much my goal, and I stopped really listening to guitarists and figuring out what they were doing and trying more realistically to try to figure out how I can make myself different from even the guys that I liked. Because it's easy to emulate the guys that you like because you love it and you want to learn it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get too far into that, then you become one of several guys who are good at that. It becomes a crutch.
Right.
To like emulate guys too much. Mm-hmm. As a result, I wound up becoming really shitty at emulating people.
Which is what we talked about earlier.
Yeah, I became better at improving myself,
mm-hmm.
and being really, really strict on myself and how to make myself better. As a result, if somebody asked me in the studio, play like this guy, play like that guy, I'm probably not the best guy to do that.
Right.
So, but those were the guys I liked as a kid.
Let's talk a little bit about Cacophony. You mentioned it, and Jason Becker.
Yeah.
When he came in, you guys met, like, he was total, like, Van Halen, Steve Vai, like that was right. his vibe.
Right.
And you said, more of an Uli John Roth and the Mahogany Rush. So it was a little bit different sides of like the guitar shredder genius.
Right, it was different. Yeah. By the time I'd met him, I'd way already developed my own thing. So mm-hmm. I didn't really sound like Uli or Marino. You know, not that I believe, maybe I did.
But I wasn't really
emulating those guys like I did when I was a kid, mm-hmm. like I was a teen. So I'd already pretty much made or baked, so to speak. That or made my stuff. My sound was already done.
Mm-hmm.
But Jason was growing. So like he was like, he could literally not only emulate things guys were doing, he'd do it better than those guys. But he just didn't really have his own direction or focus. I mean, he was copying my stuff, which mm-hmm. was very unorthodox. And he could do it nicer, more accurate, and just better than I could.
Yeah,
so I'm like, this is a guy to be in my band, to have a double guitar doing the kind of crazy stuff that I was thinking of. It's like, you can't do it by yourself. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of harmonies and layering and stuff. So that's why I originally had him in the band Cacophony, but he soon grew and blossomed into this insane composer and player that he might have been influenced by me to some extent, but he got his own thing that was just so Jason-esque, that really doesn't sound like Marty, doesn't sound like Van Halen. It just sounds like Jason, and it's just become a beautiful, beautiful composer and guitarist and maker of great music. So I'm glad that I played even a small part of that.
And it was so amazing, too, because at basically the same time, you go and get the gig with Megadeth, huge.
Yeah.
He goes and gets the gig with David Lee Roth,
right.
huge. That must have been kind of cool for you guys.
It was a moment of absolute fantastic coolness, but for both of us, and especially Jason, it was soon become very dark
mm-hmm.
because he got his ALS
right
around the time when I had this serious arm problem where
you did. Oh.
Yeah, doctors told me to stop playing music. I'll never play music again.
From what?
For I don't know what it was. It was like I had like tendons or something. I couldn't. If I shook someone's hand, it would be like an electric shock that would like
wow.
just make me jump out of my skin. So I could barely play the guitar when I was recording Rust in Peace.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor said, don't play. I'm like, you know, you're probably right, but I'm going to get another doctor's opinion.
Yeah.
The second doctor said, well, that first doctor's right, but I know you're going to ignore him. Uh-huh. You know, you're going to do that recording anyway. So play as little as you can. Don't noodle around. Just play. So
which
like
is I, like play as little as you can when yeah. you're in Megadeth.
You're in Megadeth. Your first major label album.
Yeah.
It's a ripping material.
Known for shredding guitars.
You can't wait to do your best stuff.
Yeah.
They said do one take, two takes at the most. So
wow.
I'm like, this got me in a good mindset, though. Like, you got to do the best you can at the first go.
Mm.
So it actually turned out to be a good mental thing, but it was nerve-wracking. And at the same time, Jason was telling my leg is like so limp, I can't. It's weak, it's numb, I got a problem with my leg, I don't know what it is. And both of us were like, we got these great gigs, we're going to be gods. We knew it was going to happen. That's why we broke up the band together,
mm-hmm.
because together it's too much for people to really comprehend.
But
separate, we could do something a little bit more commercial. And we both got our gigs. And, you know, and then Jason, I luckily got better and Jason didn't.
Did you have rehab or something? Or
rehab for like 6 months, every single day.
Gotcha.
I did crazy rehab and it actually worked. So thank God for that.
So yours worked, but then Jason's ALS got worse.
Jason got worse and worse.
And very quickly too, right?
And quickly got worse and worse. And it took several years for him to get to the point where he's blowing minds because he's not getting worse. He's like still, I don't know if you've seen his movie, Not Dead Yet.
I did see Not Dead Yet.
You know,
incredible. To the point where I actually even talked to Steve about maybe trying to get him on this show. I'll fly to San Francisco and talk to him. But for people that don't know, he has very advanced ALS to where he can't speak. He can't move and basically just communicates with his eyes.
Correct.
His dad has created kind of a flow chart where, like, I don't know, to the left is A and to the right, right. is B. Now, he also, can he talk?
No, he can't talk.
Does he type
at all.
And talk? Or?
No, he can't use his hands. So it's only his eyes.
Is there a computer that he can work with his eyes?
Yes, yes. There's a computer he can work with his eyes, and between his eye movements and explaining with his eye movements to his dad what to play. There's a scene in the Not Dead Yet where, you know, it shows his process of making music. But the point is, he's become more inspirational with his situation creating music like that than any of us, you know, actually playing music.
Right.
So
creates music with his mind.
With his mind, and is still creating this unbelievably beautiful music despite this illness that he has. And he never, ever complains, oh, I'm so sad, I'm so depressed. He's just been such a positive influence to so many people in regular situations like you and I. So we have a little ailment. It's like, whatever, you know, because you look at Jason, what he does despite having ALS, he's still creating music X number of years later, despite what the doctors all said was going to happen. He's just been an amazing positive influence. And to this day, my biggest influence as a person, because just looking at the things he's accomplished, it makes me want to keep working harder, harder, harder. Mm-hmm. So we actually collaborated on my album Inferno.
Did you?
Yes, we collaborated on Inferno.
So how do you collaborate with Jason when he can't move?
He has so many ideas that he's creating, musical ideas. I think he's in the process of making an album right now. So I said, dude, send me some ideas that you have.
And do you email with him? Or how do you
email with him all the time.
So he can email by using his eyes?
His eyes. And with his eyes, he communicates to his parents who type the email.
Gotcha. Okay.
So when you read his emails, you would never know, because it's the same as anyone. It's like, fuck you, man. That last song sucked or whatever. It's totally normal. Or the right. Niners suck this year or whatever.
Yeah.
Totally normal. But when we get the song going, I mean, it started off, he sent me a bunch of ideas. I say, okay, I'm going to take these, I'm going to arrange these. Just like we did in Cacophony Days, I would take my ideas and his ideas and arrange them. And so that's what I did. And the song is called Horrors. And it's an epic long song. It's like 6.5 minutes of unadulterating, just ripping our minds off, you know, just going crazy. Right. And Jason is creating this thing with ALS. And so, of course, I've got my parts that I created, but it's a group project with us together.
So just to try and get this straight, is he sending you chords, or is he actually able to do some kind of demo?
Demos.
How?
Actual demos.
How the hell do you do that?
That are done with, what do you call it, sound replacement software.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, once he's got the sheet music written all with his eyes.
Okay.
Then you can choose, okay, guitar sample,
oh,
drum
in,
sample.
In the key of E, this note or whatever,
yeah,
this chord.
Yeah. You just like sampled string sounds or sampled guitar sounds and piano sounds or drum sounds or whatever. So you can get an idea from the demos. It's pretty much just like any other demo that's done completely in the box, but it's not done typed out. It's done one single command at a time. It must take forever. But the music is all in his head, and he gets it out there. Which is just mind-boggling.
That's incredible, right?
And the music is fantastic. That's the thing. It's like, it's one thing. Oh, it's cool. He's got this disease.
Yeah,
and he makes
music.
But forget about the disease. The music that he comes up with is absolutely just gorgeous. So, and he knows that, like, we haven't played together in so long. So people are going to expect Marty and Jason, this song can't suck.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's right.
So he's like, send me some really cool stuff. And I got to come to the party and come up with some great stuff, too, to put together with it. So it was a great challenge and a great,
like,
cool
you said,
thing.
Such an inspiring person.
I'm just inspired with the guy.
If you haven't seen the movie, it's called Not Dead Yet, and it tells a story. And the one thing that the whole thing is sad, but Jason's, it seems very fun and great. Yeah. It always made me sad that we never got to see him do one tour with Roth, just to hear how he would have played those Van Halen tunes, those Steve Vai tunes. He probably would have blown them all away.
I'm telling you how good he was at all that stuff. The guy was poised to be the biggest guitar star ever. I mean, first of all, despite his playing, his character, mm-hmm. such a, there's never been a nicer guy playing a guitar. I mean, he's way nicer than me. I'm a pretty nice guy. This guy is the nicest guy. So like that whole dynamic on top of the fact that he's just doing this jaw-dropping stuff on guitar, I just couldn't wait to see what that was going to do to the world of guitar,
right.
Because it's almost like, it's almost more of a burn, you know, because if you hear this great guitar player, but you know he's an asshole, you can go, oh, well, that guy's an asshole.
Yeah.
But if you hear a great guitar player, and plus he's a cool guy, it makes you more jealous.
And then he's playing solos when doing a yo-yo trick at the same time.
Yeah, you know, so like I just saw this guy doing this thing, blowing minds, you know.
Yeah.
But like his life took a completely different and thankfully very, very inspirational turn. But I really would have loved to see him just like you did.
Yeah, just to see like what would he have done on, you know, Unchained or something like that, right?
But he would have tore it up.
Getting ready to wrap this up, when you think of all the solos that you've played over the years, is there a couple that jump out of like, these are my favorite solos?
Totally not.
No?
No.
They're all your children? You can't choose one?
Yeah, I mean, you're a singer, so you know the same thing. Once you, when you do something, you're always consciously and subconsciously trying to do better than ever you've done before.
Mm-hmm.
So theoretically, you should say that the last thing I did yesterday
is
the best thing ever.
Right.
Otherwise, you're on a slump.
What's
the
point? Yeah.
What's the point? You know, so I don't want to say, well, I did this great thing in 2006 and really haven't been able to top that. You know? But it's so true.
Was there a Megadeth song that you enjoyed playing live?
I always used to say the first song and the last song. And it's probably a similar thing in your band and in wrestling. When you first get out there, there's this adrenaline
that
you can't describe to someone who doesn't know. And at the end, you know it's about to be over. So even though you have no adrenaline left, it's going to be over. So let's just give it more.
Yeah, give it all we got.
That feeling, those two feelings are just better than any song. So I've never really had a favorite Megadeth song or solo song. It all kind of...
Everything you do is geniusly amazing.
No. Everything I do is equally fun. And
how do you put together a set list for your solo tour?
This is very interesting. I've got 12 solo albums.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So
spanning 30 years,
a lot of stuff, and it's instrumental music. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm not a fan of instrumental music. I'm bored. You know, that's the criteria when I'm making my stuff. You know, even if it's something's really interesting on guitar, I'm like, you know, it might be interesting to actually play it, but when you listen to it, who cares? Mm-hmm. You know, nobody cares. Let's get this straight for everybody. Nobody cares how difficult anything is that you do. Nobody cares.
That's a great point.
And nobody cares how interesting it is. Nobody cares how fun it is to play. What they care about is how it makes them feel. And so I can't really tell how it makes other people feel, but I can tell how it makes me feel.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you can play one A chord and it makes you feel amazing. You play it in the exact right place at the right time. Those are the things.
Right.
So I'm looking for the things that make me feel really amazing. You know, so sometimes they take an insane amount of work. Sometimes it's really easy. But nobody cares about the work you put into it. They only care about the entertainment they get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So instrumental songs... You know, 60, 90 minutes of instrumental songs, I already want to go home. So I really put a lot of effort into trying to keep it really exciting and making the songs arranged differently a little bit for live. So there's corners of the song where people can, separate members can shine and do fun stuff and get the audience involved and almost have a dialogue with the audience with music.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important to me because I'm not a big fan of instrumental music in general. So coming from that standpoint, I have to watch my band with that in mind.
Yeah.
And I look at the video and it's like, wow, he's playing some cool licks maybe, but I'm kind of bored already. So it's a lot of energy, which is not something you usually think about with instrumental music. Mm-hmm. You know, I come from punk background, you know, Kiss and the Ramones.
Right.
So it's always been simplicity and punk is what got me excited as a kid. Then I turned into this guitar guy, but I never forgot that
the attitude, vibe,
energy and sweat and adrenaline. And it's not about, well, this lick is a Phrygian diminished Mixolydian thing. Don't you care? This is hard. No, nobody cares. So like, it's always got to be like the full frontal assault kind of thing. So I try to put that energy in there somehow when I'm choosing the set list and when I'm creating the live. And that's definitely the hardest part of everything, keeping it interesting.
But it's going to be good, though. Some surprises. Marty Friedman's first tour of the United States ever.
Yeah.
What the hell took you so long, man?
I'm pumped, man. Yeah. I'm so pumped.
It's going to be cool. Is there some cities that you're excited to see? Or?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm playing my hometown, Baltimore, Maryland.
Nice.
Is the first show on the tour on the 9th of September.
September 9th, yeah.
So if everybody's not too hungover from Labor Day.
Come over and see the local guitar player.
You got to get in shape, man, because you're going to get pumped. You know, this is not like a watch the guitar player and go, wow, he's good. I'm not interested in that. I want people to jump up and down and headbang to this stuff and just didn't really have a good time and enjoy it. So
I'm sure. Yeah, I know that people are excited to see you. Yeah. A lot of people waiting. Last thing, I want you to give a message in Japanese just so I can hear you speak Japanese.
日本語聞きたいですか? それだけですか?
He's got it all set.
日本語の挨拶どうでしょうか? 日本語話してほしい。
Perfect.
It's perfect. As far as everybody in America knows.
It's perfect, too. Even when we were talking, you were going, oh, it's a Japanese style thing. We're just like, oh.
I hear it every time. You know, I didn't even notice
it. You're doing it a couple times. I noticed that.
They don't do that in America, do they?
They don't. Oh, so.
What do people do when the other person's talking?
They just maybe just go, uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Here it's like, oh, so. Oh, so.
It's a habit to make sure the other people knows that you're listening. You're engaged in the conversation.
Exactly. Yeah. Just let you're answering without saying anything.
Right.
Thanks, man. Arigato gozaimashita.
Tonde gozaimasen.
All right, thanks again to Marty Friedman. He kicked off Japan Week on Talk is Jericho. Now, don't forget, his new album is called Inferno, and he's not kidding. It is heavy, and nobody plays guitar like Marty Friedman. It is an amazing, amazing song. And like I mentioned, Marty played on the All That Remains record by Fozzy. The song was called Born of Anger, and the solo is at the end of the song. I want you to hear it. I want you to check it out. Fozzy and Marty Friedman right here on Talk is Jericho.
I can't break free. Yeah.
just hear, I mean, the first of that song is so heavy, but you could just hear Marty's style on that. Such a weird, cool, eclectic style. It was an honor to have him on that song, and it was an honor to have him on Talk is Jericho. I appreciate it. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening, and thank you for checking out all my links on Amazon. You can go buy Marty's new record, Inferno, or you can buy Fozzy All That Remains on Amazon. Remember, if you do that, just use the Talk is Jericho links. Marty's also about to do his first solo tour of the States in over 10 years, launching September 9th in his hometown of Baltimore, Maryland. You can find all the dates on his website, MartyFreeman.com. You want to see a great guitar player, go check out Marty Freeman on the Inferno tour right here in the United States. And I'll be in the States as well. There's a couple dates left on the Y2J Summer WWE Tour, including this Saturday, August 29th, San Juan, Puerto Rico, August 30th, Tallahassee, Florida, and then the summer tour is over. But don't you fret. 2 weeks later, the Y2J WWE Fall Tour begins. And it's four countries, actually. September 11th, Edmonton. September 12th, Calgary. 25th, Toronto. 26th, Syracuse. 27th, Rochester. 2nd will be in Trenton, New Jersey. October 3rd, Y2J's 25th anniversary. The exact 25th anniversary of my first show. From Ponoka, Alberta, all the way to Madison Square Garden. Not too shabby. Then October 8th, 9th, and 10th, I'm going to Saudi Arabia. October 16th, 17th, and 18th, I'm going to Mexico. With other hot young upstarts, Ric Flair and Undertaker. We're going to be going there together. And then it's no more WWE for a while. It's time to get back on the Fozzy groove. October 30th, we're heading over to Jamaica with Kiss on the Kiss Cruise, which is officially sold out. Then we head over back to Europe and the UK on the Cinderblock Party Tour with Nonpoint and Sumo Psycho. Starting November 13th in Rotterdam, we're hitting Vienna, Hamburg, Berlin, Cologne, France, Luxembourg, London, Manchester, Southampton, Birmingham, Newcastle, Sheffield, Nottingham, Wales. So many great dates. It's going to be an amazing tour. Go to FozzyRock.com. Pick up your tickets and pick up your VIP information now. And one more thing to shill. I want to shill to you guys. Thank you for being Talk is Jericho supporters. You guys who download Talk is Jericho twice a week for free and support my amazing sponsors, including Burger King, True Card, DraftKings. Don't forget, use my promo code Y2J to play for free. SeatGeek, use my promo code ChrisJ to get the $20 rebate on your first purchase. DollarShaveClub.com/Jericho. And of course, Amazon. You can pick up anything you want. You go to podcastone.com, click on the supporter show sponsors banner at the top of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button. You can do that if you're in the USA, the Canada, the UK. Every time you do that, Amazon kicks back some money to the show. So we keep doing these for you for free for nice a week. There's no extra fees or hidden challenges. You're just getting your shopping done and you're helping me out in the process. Once again, podcastone.com. Click on the supporter show sponsors banner and go through Talk is Jericho and buy whatever you want. And I'll see you this Friday. Japan Week continues with New Japan Bookers, and two of my oldest friends in the business, Jado and Gato, will be here. Another interview conducted live from a hotel room in Tokyo, Japan. And I'll tell you what, we've got some great, great stories about Mexico, about WAR, about New Japan, about WCW, about ECW. So many cool things, and you're not going to want to miss this. Jado and Gato on Friday. We'll see you then. Konnichiwa, kabawimishite, matane, yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.